Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Horror Homeroom Conversations. I'm Elizabeth Irwin.
I'm Gwen Hoffman.
And I'm Dawn Keatley.
And in today's episode, we are finally tackling the film Roger Ebert called A Raw and Painful Experience That Transcends the Genre of Terror, Horror, and the Supernatural. We are, of course, talking about William Friedkin's The Exorcist. Based on William Peter Blatty's novel of the same name, the film is an acknowledged classic, trafficking in body horror and demonic possession, scenes of which have morphed into head-turning, pea-soup-laced pop culture shorthand. But is there more to this story than meets the eye? We're breaking it all down today with spoilers, so stay tuned.
For those of you who have been living in a cave for the last 50 years, The Exorcist opens in an archaeological dig in northern Iraq, where Father Merin, Max von Sydow, finds a strange stone figure and then confronts a large statue, whom we find out later is Pazuzu. Cut to Georgetown, where most of the film takes place. The Exorcist follows Chris McNeil, played by Ellen Burstyn, and her happy, at least at first, 12-year-old daughter Reagan, played by Linda Blair. Reagan plays with a Ouija board one day, not good, and after that, her behavior becomes increasingly disturbed. Chris takes her to doctor after doctor after doctor, but Reagan just keeps getting worse. She finally goes to a psychiatrist, Reagan gets worse, and then in desperation, Chris goes to a priest, Father Karras, played by Jason Miller, who's also a psychiatrist and struggling with his own faith. The rest of the movie pretty much follows Reagan in her bedroom, tied to the bed, looking worse and worse every day, cue lots of special effects, surrounded by Father Karras and Father Merin, who try to exorcise the demon from her. The ending is kind of ambiguous. We'll probably talk about what we think happens at the end. But Father Karras does throw himself from the window, or is pushed from the window, and dies. And Reagan is restored and goes off to Europe with her mother. So that is what happens in the film. It has been called the scariest movie ever made. Mm-hmm. So I'll be interested to see what you think about that. It also earned 10 Academy Award nominations, which I didn't know until recently. That is pretty good for a horror film.
Right.
Definitely.
It won for Best Adapted Screenplay and Best Sound. And I think we can all imagine why it didn't win Best Picture when I say, well, no, I mean, it should have, in my view. But The Godfather was released in 1973.
Oh, yeah. That little film.
Yeah, a little film called The Godfather. which ended up winning Best Picture in 1973. So is it the scariest movie ever? Ever? Period?
Ever, ever?
Forever, ever? I'd say no. But that being said, that being said, I still think it holds up 50 years later.
Absolutely.
And I still think that I felt more tension in that film that I knew what was going to happen, and it has been played and replayed in so many different types of pop culture, more tension in that than I did in most films made since 2000.
I co-sign that completely. I don't think that it's as scary to me as it is disturbing.
Yeah.
And it sort of was released at the same time there was a trio of horror movies sort of dealing with demonic kids. So if you're talking about films, it was Rosemary's Baby and The Omen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If we're talking about books, it was Ira Levin's Rosemary's Baby, but it was also Thomas Tyrone's The Other. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great film to tackle after our previous conversation because all of the things I complained about in the last podcast, this movie solves for. So you do have those shocking moments, like you were saying, that hold up. You do have, it's incredibly well acted.
Yeah.
The sound layering is brilliant. And there are academic articles out there that discuss just the sound.
And that was the other Academy Award it won.
Yeah. So that doesn't surprise me at all. And I think even, I know some of the special effects feel a little bit dated, but I think it's dated in a way that actually adds to the film instead of detracts from it. So
it's got transgressions, boundary crossing, it's got shocks, it's got scares, it's got thrill building.
And they did want to give this a rated X at the time, and people were like really pushing back, like, how is this not rated X? Yeah. You do kind of look at some scenes, and they still...
One scene in particular.
Yes.
But still,
yes.
I Spit on Your Grave was what?
That had to have been an X.
Or was it like an NR or something like
Something like, yeah, perhaps.
I mean, it's pretty much a perfect horror movie. I teach it most of the time. I teach the intro to horror film class. And every time I do, I just realize this is the perfect horror movie.
Yeah.
I mean, just in its structure, the pacing, the themes it's tackling. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the only way in which it diverges from 70s horror movies and many subsequent horror movies is that it does seem to have a fairly happy ending with a resolution. And I think by the 70s, we were getting into horror movies that did not have that.
What I thought was interesting, I did some research. So that shows you how much I like this film. I actually went beyond Wikipedia. And I was reading a lot of articles by the author. And I was surprised to learn that when the movie was initially released, a lot of feedback he was getting was that people felt that evil had triumphed
over
good.
Yeah.
Which blows my mind because I never had that rating.
And he was really upset about that because he wrote the book and the screenplay out of a desire to convince people that evil existed in the world and thus that God existed in the world. And so for him, and that, you know, good should triumph. Yeah. So, I mean, how do you read the ending as the demonic triumphing?
See, that's what I was going to say. I feel like it's a temporary triumph for good.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
So,
because Reagan's saved, but the demon's not dead.
Right. Like, I never get any sense that it's resolved and wrapped up with a nice little bow.
No, but I do think the fact that it's up to Karis makes the decision, and so he retains that agency.
But, I mean, that's the question. I think it's all about Karis and whether Karis, I mean, he does yell, like, what does he say?
Come into me.
So he's trying to make that choice. But and, you know, then the demon comes into him. We see Karis's eyes turn and then Karis jumps out the window. So the question is, does the demon make Karis jump out the window to
kill
him?
See, I feel like there was a brief moment where you see him momentarily change back.
Okay,
like the eyes go from yellow back to human.
And that's when
he jumps.
Because he's hoping to dispose of Pazuzu somehow by jumping out the window, presumably.
And I think that ties into the subplot with his mother. He couldn't save his mother, but in that moment, he can make a choice that's going to save Reagan.
But then does that make him an ineffective person to be doing this? I just feel like that's, I don't know, Priest 101. Dude, you're not killing the demon that way. Like, you saved Reagan, but it's just going to move.
Well, I think because Karis was left alone and was completely ill-equipped to deal with it. And you kind of saw inklings of that when he's booted from the room because he's allowing the demon to sort of get into his head. And so I think you're right. That is sort of Priest 101. We've seen enough horror movies. We know that you don't do that with an exorcism. But I think for him, he was just sort of clutching at straws and was going completely on emotion. But how do we tie this into religion? Because this is considered to be one of... like the fundamental movies about religion, which I think I would challenge, actually.
Ooh, well, I wouldn't. But just to go back to this for a second, I guess I'm asking the wrong question because the demon is never going to go away. So the whole question of, well, does he get rid of the demon by jumping out the window? No, the demon exists. But I think the point is Damien not only stops, he not only saves Reagan, but he saves himself in a way by making the right choice, by sacrificing himself for Reagan, where, as you said, he may have felt he didn't sacrifice himself for the mother. So he saved his own soul, and he saved Reagan's soul, and what more can you do? Because evil is in the world.
But I think, too, like an added layer to that is there's a real tension for me, at least between the novel and the film. Mm. And in the novel, it is much more ambiguous as to whether or not this is an actual demon or if there's other things going on. Like, it really sort of plays with that fine line, whereas the film seems to go all in on it's a demon.
It's a demon, yeah.
So
it sure does.
It really depends, yeah. I think, what you're using as your frame of reference. What side you fall on.
So first things first, do you like the book or the movie better?
Oh, the novel, 1,000%.
Why?
There's so much. So first of all, yeah, I have to give a shout out to Lauren at Happy Haunts Library. She runs one of my favorite YouTube channels, and she recently did sort of a reread. And I had read most of The Exorcist before. I'd obviously seen the film a bunch of times. But this time I was like, I'm going to listen to it on audiobook because I know it's read by Blatty and I've heard excellent things. When I tell you that listening to it on audio completely flipped on its head everything I thought this movie and this book were about, no exaggeration. So there's a lot happening in the novel, subtextual, that we are definitely going to get into, that I left that novel thinking this is not even a book about religion, really. Religion's just sort of a metaphor for child abuse. So for me, the novel works on multiple levels because it's one of those things that I want to keep revisiting and I keep thinking about. Whereas the film, it's a bit of a disappointment to watch the film now and see like some of the creative choices that were made. Even though I appreciate it so much, I don't know that I enjoy the film the way I would have previous to listening to the audiobook.
That's fair.
Yeah.
And it is, I mean, the film is, I think whatever ambiguity there may be surrounding the ending, I mean, the film, it seems to me, is 100% clear this is a demonic possession.
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, obviously you can read that as a metaphor for something, but, you know, it's still really finally about demonic possession. And Blatty wanted it to be that. So it's interesting that listening to the book made you read it some completely different way. Like everything I've ever read about what he said, you know, he drew on a real case of possession and exorcism. He believed in possession and exorcism.
Yes.
He believed in God.
Absolutely. And I think it was the fact that it draws upon that real life case, because he goes in a lot of interviews, he does talk about how the real life priest was really upset that he wanted to, he's like, the person who he did the exorcism for does not want his story told, and this brought a lot of attention to it. And there was child abuse suspected in that case. So I think that that is sort of baked into what Blatty is trying to do. I think he's definitely telling a story because his mother was very religious and he went to Jesuit schools and, you know, so the religion is part of it. But I think when he's talking about good versus evil, he was drawing on that even subtextually.
Or maybe he didn't even realize he was doing that.
Entirely possible. Yeah. It's just, I know that my reaction, and you do bring to, you know, products of popular culture, your own experiences. Yeah. So, but I don't think that that's what's happening, because now I look at it, and we'll get into this, but of course I went searching for other academic essays because I'm like, I know I didn't come up with anything original. And weirdly, it's not written about at all. Like, I couldn't find one academic article that really dives into this.
Yeah,
I did find a YouTube essay, though, that we'll talk about.
Yeah, I mean, you should write something because I hadn't run across anything.
Yeah, well, I think this video essay does the job. Okay. Like, I don't think I need to do anything.
That was Liz's gentle.
But yeah, I guess we should talk about that, because as I had said to Liz and Gwen, like, I've watched this film God knows how many times between the 80s and now, and I never thought it was about child abuse. But you kind of said that you thought maybe
I saw it momentarily. Saw it. Like, I wouldn't say that the whole film is about that. I felt more like the film was about just generalized discord. So, like, there's just problems, chaos, these crises of whether it's faith or war or anything was all, in the home.
In the family.
Yeah, in the home was going on. Because if you think about how the whole film starts, they're in northern Iraq. And it's interesting, too, that this is situated in Washington, D.C., So then you have, you know, Nixon's involvement in, like, the Arab-Israeli war going on from, what, 69 to 73?
Yeah.
So that would have been early enough that prior to making the film. So why did we pick that? Because, of course, we can't talk about Vietnam at that time.
Right.
You know, which makes sense. So we're going to pick this, and they're going to be the other. So it's very, it's still a place of difference and a time of chaos. And then we situate this very posh family in Washington, D.C. So you have those big differences. And then, of all things, she's an actress. And what's the film set that we start out the movie with? So she's on a college campus, and it's at a time of war. And, you know, you have the students saying, we have the right to be here. We want to get the military off campus. And she's talking about how you have to fight the system from within.
Yeah.
And so you have this kind of collective chaos going on. And then you also start to see, I liked her when she said it's a Walt Disney version of Ho Chi Minh. And she was referring to the film she was making. And then you start to go to the Ouija board. So that kind of then suggests to me that there's some type of an unrest. And then we later come to find out that father is not as involved as would like to be.
As in completely absent.
I was going to say, it doesn't sound like he was involved in the marriage or the fatherhood part.
Yeah.
And mom and dad yell. And then it made me, you know, think of all these, you know, ghost movies that we watch when you have that type of chaos. It can manifest a poltergeist type thing.
Oh, I love that.
So then you have all this other chaos going on outside in the world, inside the United States, on the college campus, in the home environment, and it just kind of went from big to small. And then you start to see how Damien, the priest, has chaos going on in his life because he feels unable to care for his mother because of class. And so that was another thing that came up a lot, was class, because he wanted to do right. He was like, well, put him in the hospital. And they're like, well, what are you going to do? Pay for it?
Yeah.
Right.
You know? And so then he feels responsible because he took his vow of poverty, and he was a man of the cloth. And, you know, they even said it later on, or later on, if he would have become a psychiatrist, he would have been rich. And he could have gotten his mom all the care in the world. So it was just like this overall chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And when there's chaos, it results in these horrible, horrible things sometimes, especially if left unresolved and not worked out. It's just going to explode into something that's bigger than everybody. And it's going to come out on everybody, even unintended victims. That's all I got. That's the only smart thing I'm going to have
today.
No,
I love that. And it kind of ties in. I read a book. It's called Faces of Fear, Encounters with Creators of Modern Horror. And it's really hard to find, but I'll link to it because I found it on Internet Archive.
Ooh.
And it was really illuminating. And he talks about how there was a scene that he wrote between Marin talking to
Friedkin.
No, this is Blatty.
Blatty, okay.
Yes,
yeah.
Because he wrote the screenplay as well.
Okay,
and so
yeah.
This was what he wrote in the screenplay, that there's a scene between Father Marin talking to Father Karras, and the line is, "The demon's aim is to make us despair of our own humanity, to make us feel that we are bestial and vile, so that even if there were a God, he could not possibly love us."
Yeah.
And I feel like that kind of gets at what you're talking about, like that sense of chaos. And I also think there's a sense of suffocation happening, too. And you kind of get that in the scenes with Marin in Iraq and Karras in Georgetown. And you see it both kind of in how they're shot, like through the camera, but also like in their movements. They're just so weighted down.
Mm-hmm.
There's a kind of easy way to read it as signposting almost for the oppressiveness of religion. Mm. But I think that reading is disrupted when you think about Karras, like you were saying, with the caregiving, and then also Marin, just with the awareness that the evil that is lurking is so expansive because it takes him from Iraq all the way back to Georgetown. And I think it moves religion away from being like the source of oppression and into a source of comfort for the characters. That ties into what you were saying, because they have to be sort of the foundation of comfort within all of the chaos. And I think maybe that's how religion is being deployed. I feel like there's something happening there, like a tension.
Oh, cool. Marin felt so sad. Like he just felt like such a not empty, just like weighted. Is it good? So even like when you saw only the back of him and you didn't quite know everything that was going on when he got the notification, and it was almost as if somebody just kind of passed him a letter. He read it, and you just see his silhouette. It's like you just see him like, damn it, why do I got to be the guy that's good at this?
Yeah.
You know, like it hit him. And then even when he arrives, you never get this sense like, I'm fighting the good fight. It's more like, oh, man. like this again. It's oppressive.
It's interesting to think about that in terms of the sort of historical stuff you were talking about, because I mean, I didn't know about the Arab-Israel war that was going on at that time. That's interesting. I'll have to look up that more. I mean, I knew about Vietnam, but, you know, he's been there. I think there's a mention of him having done an exorcism in Africa, like at some point further back. And, you know, now he's drawn to Georgetown. And it is like the world is in chaos. It's not just the U.S.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's Iraq, it's Africa, all bound up in this chaos that this priest has to try to fix. And I can see the point about religion being comfort more than oppression, especially when Chris finally arrives at Father Karras. And, you know, when she meets him on that bridge and she's just like, I've been to everyone, like, I need your help. And she's never been religious, but he's the last resort. I mean, I read the film as being about like good and evil, that it's sort of about the transcendence of, you know, this sort of conflict between the demonic and the divine.
It's almost like it's fighting for what you think is right.
Yeah.
If you think about that.
It could be a whole bunch. It can be like transcendent. It can be God.
You know,
like transcendent good. It can be sort of non-conflict in the global arena, like, you know,
because she
and
was
then in the home
as the actress was, you know, fighting for the college students and for what she thought was right at home. She was constantly fighting for her daughter. And then, you know, you have them fighting against a demon. And then he wanted to fight more for his mother, but he couldn't, you know, so there was all these trying to do what's right. So even that's a bit of a, it's not always good, evil, but it's trying to do good. Although, too, I also have to give a shout out to the mom, because I feel like
I know right where you're going.
We really love to blast moms.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying she's mom of the year. Who is? There's no rule book that comes with it. You know, sometimes she might have been off doing her ritzy ditzy thing, but overall, she fought pretty hard for her kid.
Yeah.
So I had to weigh on the side of not bad, especially for a 70s horror mom, right?
Yeah. Well, she had money. I mean,
that
really helped, obviously.
Yeah, and access to a lot of doctors.
Yeah.
She sure did. But I think that this movie made conscious choices to talk about her money.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think it's interesting, and given the conversation that we've just had, like what was removed from the book. So you get inklings of the Black Mass, but it doesn't go nearly into it as much as the novel does. And I also was kind of thinking to myself, why did they remove the Sharon versus Chris God / Gnosticism debate? And I think it ties back to what you guys were saying, because it is like it does have religious components to it, but it's more than that. It's more of a morality tale than it is a religion tale.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why he may have stripped those elements of debate out of the film, out of the screenplay.
That makes sense. It's more palatable for a wider audience, too.
Yeah. That's absolutely true, because you're not engaging with, like, is there a God? Is there not a God?
Yeah.
You're engaging with what is the moral choice? What is the best choice? And people can relate to that.
Especially at that time period.
Yeah.
It's about good versus evil that can be seen to be transcendent, but then is also just good versus evil moral choices in the real world. It's interesting you said that thing about the Black Mass being removed, because, I mean, there's that shocking scene of the desecrated statue that's fairly near the beginning of the film. But that's really the only remnant in the film that there's this sort of satanic cult or something.
Yeah, it's not dived into and it's not sort of positioned the same way. Yeah. And especially because the version I watch, it started in Iraq. So it was the original one.
Yeah.
And you kind of get some of that like mythos there. And it kind of felt like the desecration scene was just a callback to show it's everywhere. It's not just isolated to one area. Whereas in the novel, it's very clearly, you know, a satanic issue and a way to show that Reagan is potentially possessed.
I know. I can't believe how much they doubted it.
Well, we should get to the abuse, but I guess we also have to talk about how incredibly gendered this film is.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And that is, you know, that's, I guess, one of the things that makes it like a good film to teach, like an exemplary horror film, because Carol Clover has actually written about it, you know, chainsaws.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, she says that the Exorcist is not really a possession film so much as a film about males in crisis.
Mm.
And you know, there's the possessed Reagan at the center of the film, right? But actually, the film is about all the men around her. I mean, and there are, like, she's constantly surrounded by men, like all the doctors and the psychiatrists. And then the last half of third of the film, she's surrounded by priests who are trying to, in a sense, convince themselves that the world is ordered by their, you know, beliefs, and trying to shore up their faith over her body. And her body, she doesn't really matter.
What does she say about the mom? Does she mention that?
No, she doesn't really mention.
Because the people whose pain that I actually felt the most through, like, I think for more than moments, was Chris and then Damien.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Because Damien is throughout, but it's almost like they paralleled one another.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't have access to help. She had access to help. And we'll get into that, too, if we talk about caregiving.
Yeah.
But, you know, they both seem to be in pain in different ways. But you just see her utter anguish, like having to suck up everything, like you mentioned, on the bridge and just be like, hey, do you know a guy about an exorcist?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, as she's when got a bruised face.
Yeah.
You know, and she's got to go toe-to-toe with these male doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, again, she had some authority because she was a famous actress.
Yeah.
You know, because even just a plain, rich, white woman might not have that same access because she had the notoriety. But she went toe-to-toe and was like, no, you're not listening to me. Your science isn't working. I tried fighting from the inside the system. So now I'm going to have to go outside.
Yeah. I like that because one of the things I was struck by was sort of the parallel between religious work as an extension of caregiving. And what's interesting about what you said is that in the novel, it really does dive deeper into them having to convince the church to allow the exorcism to happen. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of that same toe-to-toe that you're talking about that you see echoed with Chris and the doctors. So I think there's a lot of parallels that support what you're saying.
Yeah, I thought about, and I know that you and I talked about this prior to even coming up with this idea, is I thought about a lot of the caregiving issues. And I know that that's not the intent, per se. It was just part of a way to drive the narrative. But I mean, they were very intented on the parallel between Damien and Chris on how she could afford the care and what that care looks like. She was able to come up with a resolution.
Yeah.
Because she had agency, she had power, she had money, she had everything.
Huh.
He didn't.
Yeah.
And so then he blames himself for her dying, even though she was older, she seemed frail, like the circumstances are completely different, obviously, but he didn't have the same access as she did. And then I also would see the film in terms of caregiving, because if you take possession aside, if you think about just Reagan and her mom, the experience itself is almost as if you have, I thought of Zelda in Pet Sematary.
Yes.
You have this thing in your upper bedrooms that you can't talk to anybody about, or you're going through this thing that's not widely able to be talked about. Everybody likes to weigh in with their ideas and thoughts and opinions. They're not actually listening. They're not understanding. You're not understanding sometimes. Like, why is this happening to my person? Why is this happening to my family? Why? And then trying to figure out how to overcome it sometimes on your own, and just the sickness and the changes in the body that sometimes happen when you have somebody that's ill in your life. And that's what I thought of with the film itself. Like I said, I know it's not the intent, but it evoked that for me.
And it still comes at a cost. Even though this woman has power and privilege, she's still forced to give up something professionally. Like, she's about to direct her first film.
She stops working.
Yeah. I mean, she has to give up something in order to be successful. So you can't just have a woman who's able to access these things without there being a cost.
And there are so many parallels. I never really thought about this completely, but there are so many parallels between Chris and her daughter in the bedroom. And I love that comparison to Zelda. It's totally like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think at one point I counted there are like at least 10 scenes of people going up the steps or the camera tracking to her bedroom door. And, you know, people can say it's about Reagan's sexuality, but I think it's equally, like you guys just said, it's about the caregiver that you can't talk about, that whose body is changing and becoming unmanageable and kind of ruining your life.
And they're not the person that they were.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, but Damien and his mother, like, he makes that same trek out to wherever she lives in New York, into her room. He kind of cares for her because, you know, her leg is wounded. And then, of course, he sees her on Reagan's bed in that one moment where the demon apparently, like, changes and shows him his mother. But that completely aligns the two situations. I mean, it's almost like it does sort of turn what Reagan is into a metaphor for the sick relative, like his mother, and like all those women in that mental hospital, and that sort of really uncanny, eerie scene when he walks through to his mother and they're all like reaching at him, almost like they're possessed. I mean, the film is almost making a like an analogy between possession and sickness, whether it's mental sickness, physical sickness.
What do you think is happening in the scene where he has the, where Father Harris has the dream and he sees the mother at a distance and she's
at the subway station?
Because that feels to me like a potential parallel.
Doesn't she? She sort of stands there and waves at him, right?
And kind of calls to him.
Yeah. And she's like, Demi. You can't hear what she's saying.
And you can tell that he's, like, there's an impotence to the scene where he can't, he's not very responsive. And it felt a little bit like
it,
Reagan.
But he can't reach her.
I was going to say, I took it pretty face value. Like, she seemed to be as if she was going to walk into traffic. So he was trying to, like, stop her to protect her. And then he's trying to get to her. And then he can't. And she turns around and walks away. So to me, it was almost like that was representative of his thoughts of how he couldn't get to her when she got sick. He wasn't there for her in the way he would like to. That's part of his crisis of faith. Like, if I didn't make this decision, then I could have taken care of her. So it just felt like his guilt and shame.
I think so, because I was thinking maybe it's like that intersection of grief and guilt that like is corroding him from the inside, the same way the demon being inside of Reagan. And that there's like an echoing there, and that's probably why the demon is able to tap into his fears and his regrets so easily.
Well, in that dream, I think, and I can't remember if it's before or after he sees his mother, he sees that medallion falling.
The Saint Joseph.
Yeah, which is I think a medallion that was in Iraq and then is in Georgetown. So it's the strange medallion that kind of seems to go along with that little statue of Pazuzu. And again, you can read it as like evil and good. They're sort of all over the place inexplicably, and you have to choose which one. Because I think the medallion is like falling, like it's been ripped off in his dream. Which suggests, you know.
And that was his medallion, like, right? The one that we see again at the end. I think that was St. Joseph. So that's supposed to be like the assumed father of Jesus, you know, like Mary and Joseph, Joseph. And like the paternal, caring kind of, you know, fatherly.
And doesn't that Father Dyer gives it to Reagan at the end, right? Or gives it to Chris, or there's some exchanging of that medallion.
Chris ends up handing it off to the other priest.
Father Dyer. Okay.
Father Dyer. Yeah.
Well, okay. But abuse.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't see it.
Okay,
don't
so
really see it.
That's okay. That's okay.
You'll have to link to this video essay.
I will. I'm going to link to everything we talk about. No problems there. So for me, when I was listening to it, there's a very sort of detailed paragraph where they're describing the change in Reagan and about how she went from sort of this happy-go-lucky, as you said, child to someone sullen and withdrawn and who uses highly sexualized language. And at first it's sort of played as a little bit of a joke between Chris and the doctor because of the words that she's using. But just in that description about like this shift between well-adjusted child to sort of sullen and using that highly sexualized language, that was when I felt like someone threw ice on me. I was like, this is about an abused child. And then the scene happens with the urination at the party. And that is such a clear sign. But for me, the crucifixion scene, which I've always struggled with in the book and in the film, because it's so graphic and it's so violent. And, you know, the abuse of children, especially the sexual abuse of children, is violent. And to me, it made that scene make sense when you take those other components. Like I said, I think it's extremely clear in the book. The movie, I don't think it's clear in. But like I said, I went looking for this video essay and, or, you know, just scholarship in general. And it's by Qualitative Learning. And they go into things that I didn't even think about. So they mention the shaking of the bed and the wrapped bedposts that are made to look phallic.
Yeah.
And he floats a theory that Burke Dennings is the one abusing
Reagan.
That's
what I was going to say. And that's the only time I saw it was with Burke.
But in this video essay, he talks about that. And he says, you know, in the original Spider Walk, Reagan attacks Sharon.
Yeah.
And this comes after the moment where Chris is really angry at Sharon because she left Reagan home alone with Dennings. And so the idea is that, you know, she's attacking Sharon because she's culpable in the abuse that was perpetuated. And the other thing that I thought was interesting that he mentioned is the actor who plays Dennings, his voice is used in the scene where Reagan is cursing. So, of course, you know, I'm a super nerd, so I had to go looking for this. And I looked up the script, and there's actually a part where right after there's the exchange between Chris and Reagan where Reagan's like, oh, he's your boyfriend, and she's like, no, he's my friend, that cuts directly to the urination scene. And if you look in the script, it says Reagan / Dennings' voice.
Oh.
So why has Dennings' voice been internalized to that degree? I mean, you could say because he's the one who would use all the vulgar language, but she's echoing the same words in the same type of syntax as Dennings.
And,
so,
and that's in the urination scene that she takes his
voice. That comes first.
Well, no. So she's having the conversation with Chris. Yeah. Then it shifts to the party where there's the urination. Yeah. And she's like, he's going to kill you.
Yeah, you're going to die up there.
Yeah, but she doesn't say it to Dennings. She says it to the astronaut. But Dennings is the one who dies up there when he's left alone in the bedroom with her. So I think, like I said, I think it's much more obvious to me in the novel. I feel like in the film, it doesn't, it's not as detailed, but
I'm feeling pretty convinced.
Qualitative Learning, the person who wrote that essay would say the opposite. He would say it's more evident in the movie.
Film.
Yeah. So I don't necessarily agree with that. But
yeah, I only saw it at that moment. Like that's where I wrote the note, like abuse question mark.
Yeah.
Which moment?
So right around, so the wedding herself happened first. Because again, I went looking for it because you had mentioned that this was a theme that had come up. So I was like, okay, the wedding yourself and you're going to die upstairs. And then, you know, there was other statements like, is there someone inside of you? Now I know that that was referencing something else. And then later on when she becomes so overt, first when mom finds out that Reagan was alone upstairs, she gets mad. She attacks her friend.
Sharon.
And then seemed upset that it was Burke that she called to come over.
Right.
Almost like, wait, what? And then was he up there? And she says, was Dennings going into her room? Why would that be the first thing that gets into your mind is Dennings going into her room? And then that's when you immediately go to do it, lick me, your cunting daughter, like so on and so forth. Like, and it was very overt that that switch had happened. And then that's when she really kind of tended to lurch into the evil is after we've recognized that Dennings went into her room and was immediately thrust out.
Yes.
So, and then also, too, she asks questions like, what's wrong with me?
And there's a cut scene, too, that the video essay mentions about when Reagan is surrounded by the doctors and she's resisting them because they're trying to probe her and she doesn't want to be touched. And that reaction is it just seems so classic to me that it's hard for me to think that it wasn't intentional on some level.
I mean, other little bits of evidence are the fact that I mean, this isn't conclusive, but there isn't a sexual relationship between Burke Dennings and Chris.
No.
And, you know, maybe that's because he doesn't like adult women.
Or maybe she just kind of knew.
Maybe she knew because now I'm thinking, too, like when she finds out that Burke's dead and has been thrown from the window, I mean, she's shocked and upset. But I wonder if she's shocked and upset because she knows what might have caused
Reagan, she didn't say anything at first.
Out the window.
Like, it felt like later at the end, she was like, you know, my daughter did that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at first, that never would have, she just kind of shut her mouth.
Yeah.
And didn't say anything. So why do we think it chose Reagan?
Because she played with the Ouija board. Have we learned nothing,
people? Yeah. Like, especially on the back of the last film that we did, there's rules.
Yeah.
There's rules. Like, even her mom was like, I don't think you're supposed to play that thing alone.
I want to know more about Captain Howdy.
Me too.
And how that
factors in. Although he's in, what's it, Strangeland? When Dee Snider does that movie, Strangeland.
A-plus reference.
Captain Howdy. Yes.
Oh, my God. One of the essays that I read, I'm going to link to everything. They talk about how Reagan being sort of subsumed by the demon was meant to impact the other people around her. It really wasn't about Reagan.
Yeah.
It was about sort of traumatizing the people around her.
Well, that was the quote that you read. It was from a cut scene when Marin and Karis are sitting on the staircase. It's one of the scenes that Friedkin famously left out because he thought it was too obvious, that it was beating viewers over the head. But actually, Kara says, why this girl?
Yeah.
And he's asking, why Reagan? And Marin says, I think the point is to make us despair, to see ourselves as animal and ugly, to reject the possibility that God could love us.
Yeah.
But that doesn't answer the question, why Reagan?
Collateral damage.
And actually, Karis doesn't ask that. He says, why this girl? And I think that's interesting. Why this girl? Which brings in all of the gendered, you know, characteristics of the film.
But if you take it back to what we were saying about just morality and chaos, that tracks, like, there's collateral damage.
Yeah.
So in these wars, which is, you know,
oh, yeah.
these othered places and, you know, the things that DC does in other countries, possibly, there's just a lot of innocent, unintended victims.
Yeah.
I think it's a little different, too, because I'm thinking of other possession movies. Usually there's some sort of trespass.
Yeah.
And honestly, Reagan doesn't trespass. I mean, I was kind of joking about the Ouija board.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not really a trespass.
Yeah. That's a sixth grade slumber party.
Yeah. I mean, she really doesn't do anything to invite the demon in.
Yeah. I kind of wish they'd left the Ouija board part out.
Me too.
Yeah, I agree.
Because I think beside that very quick reference, it does seem random that it chose Reagan. And she didn't do anything.
No.
And I guess that's part of the point of the film. And the Ouija board kind of makes it a little sort of hokey. Well, the demon chose her because she used her Ouija board. When really, I think the point is, it is random. Like, it could have happened anywhere.
Yeah. Which would make more sense in a 1970s film.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It could hit anybody.
Yeah.
So do we talk about the parodies?
Oh, we definitely have to talk about the parodies. And then at some point, too, we'll have to circle back because I do want to see if you think that Omen is better. We're going to have to touch
on
that.
Yeah.
We're going to have to touch on that. Because I think that you have to discuss it within sort of the realm of these other films like Rosemary's Baby and Omen at some point. Like maybe who did it best, you know?
Who did it best?
So we'll come back to that. But we have to
think about our
parodies.
Yes.
Repossessed, period. Repossessed.
Repossessed is so bad. It's so
bad, but it's so good.
Is it supposed to be a parody?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
it is.
Okay. Leslie Nielsen doing Airport, but make it Exorcist.
Airplane, yeah.
yeah, Airplane. Sorry, yeah.
It is.
It's so bad.
And Linda Blair's in it.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
When did it come out? 70s?
Oh, 80s?
80, it had to be 80s.
Because he did all those Airplane movies. I mean, he was big in the 80s, so... Oh, it's typical.
I like the Scary Movie 2 one. That makes me laugh probably the most.
Yeah.
But there is a list of different send-ups of The Exorcist, and they also include French and Saunders, which I know both of us enjoy. I didn't even know until I read that list that they had done that, but it's really good.
I love them.
The Simpsons, and apparently there's something called Scared Shrek List that I've never heard about, but you can bet I'm going to look for. But I kind of wanted to get into... The Exorcist is ubiquitous, right?
Mm-hmm.
People who don't know anything about the movie really know certain scenes, right?
The pea soup,
the head spinning around.
Yeah. It's like Jaws. Yeah. You didn't have to see Jaws to know.
Yeah, exactly.
Didn't, you know?
Yeah.
So what do you think that does to an audience experiencing The Exorcist for the first time? Do you think that's going to take away some of the terror and the horror? Or do you think it's going to amplify it?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I don't think so either.
Because I hadn't watched this in a long time. So I had even forgotten some of the stuff, like the in-depth storytelling leading up. the pacing. Like, I had forgotten a lot. And even, too, I know that the pea soup is a weird color of green, but it didn't seem to really bother me.
No, it doesn't bother me either.
Like, it didn't detract from anything. So even though it's so many years later, the special effects are so different. I even knew what was going to happen. I had had a million and one references. I just feel like it still just held up.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's so embedded in a realistic story and a realistic place. And everything about the camera work is realistic that I think even if you've watched all the parodies, you're kind of worked out of that. Like, you're put in a real place with a, you know, a real demon. I mean, I do think the pacing's perfect. And all of the hospital scenes. I mean, and that's where people fainted and got nauseous.
Oh, where the blood was spurting out?
Yeah, when she's in the hospital and getting the needles stuck into her for the whatever.
It was fantastic.
The thing in her, oh, the spinal tap, that's it. I mean, you know, if anyone's thinking they're going to laugh through this film, I mean, that will stop them.
Can we also address, I know you were ready to say something, but I'm thinking about shocking moments. Yo, nobody cared that this priest jumped off the bed and beat a child about the face.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and I know that there's a demon in there. Don't get me wrong.
It was the 70s. Parenting looked very different, Gwen.
Weren't you and I born in the 70s?
Yeah.
So it makes a lot of sense. But, like, that was one of the more, even though I know it happens and that it's not, in theory, her, I was like, oh, my God. God, like,
it's vicious.
He just unleashed. Like, I can handle the see you next Tuesday words. Like, I felt like that's par for the course for the 70s, but wow.
Was she still being played by Linda Blair at that point? Because wasn't there was another woman involved in her voice, Mercedes something? I can't remember.
I don't know.
But yeah, I think that was Linda Blair. When he was punching her. Yeah.
Because she certainly said, like, a lot of the words, because she gave an interview where she said as a child that was, like, a struggle for her.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the other thing that I think about. Like, the, you know, what do we think about her having to live through that movie?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, as a child.
About how hard it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't think of another horror movie that has as brutal a scene to me as the crucifixion scene. It is so hard to watch, even if you know it's coming, even if you've seen this movie before. And in the novel, it goes on and on and on. At least in the film, it's like 10 seconds, but it feels so much longer. And it's just so violent. I can't believe that this even made it onto film. I mean, I know some of these films are different, but that to me is still the most shocking moment. I can't think of another moment in horror movies that just shocks me as much as that.
And it's hard to believe that that was written in the novel and in the screenplay by somebody who claimed that, you know, he's a devout Christian.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people were shocked at that scene, including, you know, religious types.
Yeah. It's just so violent.
Yeah.
Oh, I wonder if it was also a conscious decision, because now I'm just thinking about the wording. And I was trying to count how many times that Chris would say things like, Jesus Christ, God damn it, you know, Judas Priest, for Christ's sake.
All the time.
It was just
constant. I never thought of that.
So maybe that's her transgression, is taking the Lord's name in vain over and over and over. Yeah. It's positing her as this non-Christian. Because she's the only one that they really had use that language.
Yeah.
I mean, because the worst thing that the drunk producer said was, you're a Nazi. Yeah, Nazi pig. But everybody else doesn't say all of these specifically Lord's name in vain type things.
That's true.
Yeah.
But that was just a side thought.
I wonder if it's supposed to show that she has something in her that is prone to believe, even though she's denying it and claims she's an atheist.
It's a good call.
I like that.
I mean, because she does obviously come around to trusting Damien more than anyone else by the end.
And to wrap back to what Gwen was asking, Damien,
no.
That has to be intentional.
Yeah.
I thought about that too.
Has
I'm like,
to
come
be.
On.
Has
really?
To be.
Wait, which one was first?
This one was first.
This came before The Omen. Okay. I mean, I love The Omen, but I feel like The Exorcist is a better made film.
Just I would agree with that.
Yeah. Pacing and the acting and the cinematography. I think one of the creepiest scenes in horror is when Damien, isn't he? He's outside looking up at the house kind of makes the governess hang herself out the window.
See, but we've talked about this before. Like, which do you think is scarier? You've got Rosemary's Baby, Omen. So we're going to stick it to like movies. Rosemary's Baby, Omen, and The Exorcist. What is the scariest and why?
I mean, for me, the Exorcist is the scariest because it feels the most real, weirdly. I mean, The Omen is, it's not scary. It's like.
Yeah, I feel the same about The Omen.
I think I enjoy The Omen more. To me, the more disturbing movie is definitely this one.
Yeah.
Because The Omen doesn't disturb me. But
yeah, The Omen doesn't disturb me.
Like, I got to amp myself up to watch this movie because I do find it so disturbing. But I don't find it scary.
Yeah. I think I just also like the randomness of Regan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas Damien felt concerted. And same thing with Rosemary's Baby. Yeah. Like, there's an effort. These boneheads brought you into the world with this intent, you know, knowingly are trying to do this. And so it's the actions of adults that are knowingly acting in a certain way. So it didn't feel that much like, I don't know, I felt like they got what they deserved a little bit in many cases. Whereas this was just so random, a side of the Ouija board. And even still, you can chalk that up to a childhood indiscretion. You know, you do dumb things when you're young. And
you don't deserve that.
And you don't deserve that. You know? No kids deserve it. You know, you drive drunk, you think you're invincible, and you wrap yourself around a tree. You're not going to say that they deserve it. You know, these things are horrible that happen because you're young and you think you're invincible.
I also think The Exorcist is disturbing because it shows the modern world, like, realistically failing. I mean, obviously in The Omen, like, you know, the son of the devil is going to take over the world.
Again, all rich people.
Know, that's not going to happen. But in The Exorcist, like, all those scenes of doctors failing and psychiatrists failing and society kind of crumbling in a realistic way. I mean, I just think that's kind of disturbing. And then all you have left at the end are two priests. Mm-hmm. And one of them's really old. And the other one doubts, and they seem to be holding the world together.
Yeah.
I just find that really kind of existentially disturbing.
Yeah, I agree. It makes a nice pairing, I think, with Carrie and Carrie's mother, who I still find incredibly disturbing.
Absolutely.
I feel like taken in tandem, those are the two like movies to me. It's not really The Omen.
Yeah, they're very different.
Oh, very different.
Views of religion.
Mm-hmm.
When was Flowers in the Attic? When did that first come out? Was that 80s?
Oh, definitely the 80s. Mm. Had to be the 80s, right? I feel like all V.C. Andrews and all her tawdriness, I feel like.
Late 70s. Oh, but maybe. I could be wrong.
I was thinking early 80s, but.
Are we talking about a novel?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Oh, I was
you
thinking about the movie.
No,
I think the novel was late 70s. I thought you meant
that's
the movie.
What I thought.
Yeah, I was talking about the movie.
Oh, okay. That's definitely 80s.
Yeah.
You know what I love, though, in this rewatch is that it cemented to me that this whole notion of elevated horror, which I think all of us call bullshit on.
Yeah.
This cements it, right? Because you have the beautiful storytelling. You have the beautiful performances. This is clearly a movie that people poured money into. Mm-hmm. If this was released today, it would be given that prestige horror, when in reality, now it's just considered one of the best horror movies.
Yeah, it's a horror movie.
Yeah, no qualifiers attached.
No elevated.
It's what horror
I'm
is supposed
just
to be.
Saying. Yeah. I hate that term, elevated horror.
So the novel, Flowers in the Attic, is 1979.
Nine, okay.
But the first film was 1987.
Oh, okay.
So that was.
Later than I thought.
Yeah.
And not for nothing, but the Faces of Fear book that I mentioned also has an interview with V.C. Andrews. And wow, I can't recommend this book enough. Like, these authors are something.
So do we think that they deserve the award for the music?
Yes.
Yeah,
oh,
me
definitely.
Too.
The 100%.
The sound in that film was great.
Absolutely. Yeah, I feel like it was the foundation for even like a Michael Myers.
Yeah.
Like, it really solidified what that creepiness is supposed to sound like in the background.
Yeah. It is, you got to believe Carpenter ripped this film off a little bit. I mean, the scene where Chris is walking along the Georgetown streets and that music and the leaves are blowing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she sees somebody, maybe nuns with long flowing cloaks that are like the kids in costumes that Laurie sees in Halloween.
Very, I made note of that scene of the sort of the habits flowing. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we are all for The Exorcist.
Yeah.
But read the novel first, please, and then come and yell at me that that is not present in the novel at all. I say it is.
Apparently, listen to it on Audible.
Yeah.
Yes.
If I didn't realize Blatty read that.
He does such a phenomenal job that it was worth, I think it's a ridiculously long version because he's very like methodical about the words. Listen to it on regular speed. Don't be speeding it up. It's I can't recommend it enough. It's so good. Gwen's looking at me like,
I didn't even know that was a thing.
Ever.
I was like, I didn't even know you could speed it up. That's not a thing. I just turn pages. I don't understand.
Well, yeah.
This witchcraft.
That's very true. Anything else that we want to say about The Exorcist? I mean, there's so much that we could talk about, but I feel like that's a good overview.
That's the main thing.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay. So what do you think we're going to do for next month? I mean.
Oh, my God. Isn't Thanksgiving coming out or something like that?
That is. But do we want.
Slaughterhouse?
I was going to say. Slaughterhouse. Do we want to do the best movie of 2024, according to me? Which is Slaughterhouse.
Wait, you mean 2023?
Did I say 2023?
Maybe it's probably going to be both. Let's be honest.
Did I say
them out. You said 2024.
Listen, guys. All the hate mail you can direct specifically to me, but you have to find me first.
I'll take some. You're just going to have to send it by carrier pigeon.
Okay, I'm 100% down with Slaughterhouse.
You are going to hate every second.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a horror comedy.
Okay, but...
Are you okay with that?
I do actually, it turns out, like some horror comedies. Shaun of the Dead, Happy Death Day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's true. That's not this, but that's true.
Okay.
I mean,
if you were...
I mean, I did watch Zombievers, so...
Okay. If you are for real saying that you think it's the best horror movie of 2023.
I'll say this. I think it's the best movie of 2023 that I enjoyed. It's the horror movie that I enjoyed the
most. That you enjoyed the most.
Yes. Is it the best movie? I mean, I guess it's not gonna get an Academy Award. Will vary. To me, I think it's hysterical, but...
Okay, Slaughterhouse it is.
Although at some point, too, we'll have to do something Christmassy for December.
Oh, yeah, we really probably
there's nothing
should.
Better than Christmas horror, man.
It seems like Slaughterhouse will be next.
Dawn's going to be sick that day.
Get watching.
I would feel really bad because you're going to hate it. But
we
anyway.
Might manifest Pazuzu because she's going to be cursing us as she's watching it.
She's going to be like, you're kicked out of the podcast. But anyway, in the meantime, you can find us on all things Horror Homeroom on social media for the most part. Okay, let me revise that. You can find us on X and you can find us on Facebook. Is that right, Stella? That's right.
That is correct.
And snail mail.
We have a healthy presence on Twitter/X and Facebook.
And we occasionally have an Instagram post if I'm bored at work. That's about the extent of it. But in the meantime, we will talk to you later.
Bye.